Hello and welcome back to Big Mouth, the show that resembles the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark, except with piles of DVDs and books instead of ancient Talmudic relics. I'm Andrew Harrison, and joining me as ever is Sean Pattenden, the dashing Carrie Fisher to my decrepit Harrison Ford, he said, mixing his movies. Hello, Sean, how are you doing?
I'm all right, thank you.
Exciting week?
Very exciting, actually, yes.
What's been happening?
Well, art pop-ups may be afoot in July.
Art pop-ups, where? Yeah. In London's famous London?
In London's famous boutique hotel that hasn't opened yet, which is quite a good idea, yeah. So we could bring our degenerate art into Fancy Pants land.
Watch this space.
Oh, yes.
Would you like to get the ball rolling by introducing the first of today's very, very special guests?
I certainly would, Andrew Harrison. He's the Telegraph's TV writer. He's also written for The Guardian and numerous other papers. And in past lives, he's both the editor of Sky magazine and editor-at-large of Zoo magazine, the long-lost lads weekly. Long lot. Hello, Michael Hogan. How are you? Welcome back to Big Mouth.
It's very lovely to be here. I'm very good, thank you.
Do you think that we live in quite a Sky magazine world now?
I think we do. Yeah.
Roles, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. We should bring it back.
What was the best feature that Sky ever did, in your opinion, under your leadership?
Wow. Well, the one that everyone tends to remember, actually, not the best, is Friends Who Sleep With Each Other, with our regular down the back.
In every sense.
I mean, the feature.
So, yeah, I used to work for Moore magazine. Everyone remembers Position of the Fortnight from that.
Of course. I forgot.
And then, you know, so it's almost like people remember the sex one.
I remember doing something for Sky, and you let me do something about art, and that which was really good. And I ended up ringing Tracy Emin, who had her shop at the time, and going, Tracy, can you give me a really, really big hand here? You can't see this picture, but I'm meant to be asking artists about it. Can I just ask you over the phone? She went, all right. So that's good. We got an exclusive with Tracy Emin with that.
Extraordinary.
There you go.
They should totally bring back Sky, though, shouldn't they? Because it is the world of now. It is sort of, you know, if Sky was around now, then Kim Kardashian and Kanye alone would be enough to pop up the magazine.
But as I say, there were other bits to it, and there was lots of art, and there was good culture.
Yeah, it was like, Sky, you know, it was like the sort of smash hits version of The Face, which we all need. There's a lot to love about that description.
Absolutely, yeah.
You work for Zoo. Should we bring Zoom back again, do you think?
No. The internet does all that.
All right. Although maybe a magazine about actual zoos.
The whole zoo period of my life was a massive mix-up. I thought it was going to be about monkeys.
In a way, it was.
Fair enough.
Also joining us this week, she covers TV and podcasts for The Guardian, slides tenor across the desk, and bits for the indie as well. She's a graduate of the Smash Hit School of Gifted Youngsters. And now she is, as her Twitter blog says, your private writer, your writer for money. Hello, Hannah.
Hiya.
We presume that any old feature will do.
It certainly will, if the time's right.
Absolutely. What podcast have you been discovering of late in your podcast explorations?
I've been loving Ear Hustle, which is actually from inside a prison. And it's a very harrowing listen, but it's also really, really sensitive. I'd really recommend it.
It's really funny as well, isn't it? I mean, I listened to the one about, like, meeting your cellmates. Not dissimilar from the Big Mouth studio, actually. Small people crammed into a small, hot space. Very intimate. But it's like, you're going to have to live with this guy for however long your sentence is. And you better make sure that they are, you know, that you're compatible. A bit like friends who sleep together at the back of Sky magazine.
Mm. That's true. If they breathe wrongly, then they just annoy you. And sometimes you wake up and they're standing over your bed with a knife.
Yeah. Ooh. But a lot of the kind of complaints about cellies were it wasn't like he's violent or he's crazy. It was like he's got this really annoying habit of the way he, you know, he moves his knife and fork around the plate. It really drives me crazy.
And there was one that was a cellie with a smoker, and the man was just like, I'm on a life term here. I'm going to smoke. I want to cut it down. I'm going to do what I want.
Do you think the podcast world is changing? There seems to be more and more and more of them. And people are it's kind of gone past the first burst of, hey, this is the new thing. And into it's actually become people's staple diet of listening now.
Yes, I used to think that only media people in London listen to them. But I think this is the year when it gradually shifts. I mean, true crime's been a really massive thing. But now We're getting brands, we're getting everyone wants to do a podcast without quite knowing where it is or what it is. But I think that's a good thing. Not that it's ever going to replace radio, but the more the merrier, I think, because they do weed out the rubbish ones because they just don't get very popular.
Well, we better crack on then. Don't get weeded out.
Not like
out.
This excellent one.
Yeah, better crack on. Let's, Sean, what's on this week's show?
Funny you should ask that. There's a Studio 54 documentary coming out, and we got aboard a white horse and rode to the cinema to check it out. Where does the myth of disco's ground zero meet the reality of, spoilers, paying your taxes? Plus, new albums from Kanye West. When will we draw the line on the hip-hop Morrissey? Although everybody's Morrissey now, do you not agree? And Lily Allen, has she made some good pop songs this time? All these things after this important message.
This is your gentle reminder to do your bit to keep Big Mouth on the up and up. We're asking listeners to pony up a mere fiver a month, the equivalent of a pint of beer at those awful London prices, via the crowdfunding platform Patreon, just to cover our bills. We're well over halfway to our target of £600 a month, after which we'll start recording extra bits each week for our Patreon backers. So if you like Big Mouth and you want us to keep on keeping on, go to patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast to find out more. And the link's at the top of the Big Mouth Facebook page too. All we are saying is, buy us a pint. So, that Studio 54 movie. It was, of course, the temple of 70s excess, where queer New York, rich New York, international celebrity and lowlife collided under a giant crescent moon with a spoon at its nose for some reason. A new documentary by Matt Ternauer tells the story of the rise and calamitous fall of Brooklynites Ian Schrager and Steve Rubell and their club, and how their lives went down with it. To get you in the mood, what else? It's Sylvester's You Make Me Feel Mighty Real, literally the greatest record ever made. Make Me Feel Mighty Real. We might as well just stop the show right now and play it again. From Studio 54, the new documentary out in cinemas on the 15th of June. Hannah Verdier, you were quite overcome by this movie when we went to see it.
All right, so I had two cries.
That's pretty good going for me.
That's pretty overcome.
Why did it hit you so hard? Why did it speak to you?
Well, I love rockumentaries and I absolutely love disco, but I didn't know half the story, so I love it when I learned loads. But the bits that really got me were the whole euphoria of it. There's a moment when it's like we're trying to get in the club and Sylvester's playing a little muffled way in the background and they're talking about checking your coat and going down the corridor, and then all of a sudden You Make Me Feel Mighty Real bursts out, and
it's
I was just like, oh, I'm there.
You open I thought it was beautifully constructed because the camera is walking you through Scorsese style, and you can hear the music muffled. You can just hear the bop. And the anticipation builds and builds. And as the doors open, it's almost like what I'm told it's like when one takes disco party drugs. You just absolutely pop as a clock, explosion of euphoria. And I was absolutely plastered to my seat over this.
I know, I felt I was like in the legendary Chic story trying to get in. Mm. But also it had so much going for it. It's got all the glamour. But I was really struck by the design and Ian Schrager. Because, I mean, I love his hotels and I didn't realise how important the design was. The sun would come up and set, and every single bit was so well thought out.
And each evening was a separately kind of choreographed, theatrically directed thing, wasn't it? It's surprising that the club, it opened in 1977, April 1977. It was only open for 33 months. They didn't even bother to get a liquor license, which with hilarious consequences. Yes. But they kept changing it and reinventing it on an almost weekly basis.
Yeah, and I think it was very much of that time. And the other bit that got me was a bit at the end, that it was like that period between the pill coming available and AIDS not yet being discovered.
Yeah.
And everyone just had such a good time. And it was a time of free love. And then it all came crashing down.
Yeah, there is great poignancy to it, isn't there?
Yeah, that was a bit that really got me, yeah.
Michael, what did you make of the movie? Were you dancing around in your rhinestone underwear?
I was, yeah. It kind of be, which is quite uncomfortable sometimes in the cinema scene.
Yeah.
There was some chafing. I really liked it, but I thought it was very much, it's a film of two halves for me. I just loved the first half of the film and the second half of the film less so. I mean, the first half of the film about Studio 54 being sort of built and designed and set up, and the opening night, as you say, that sequence is amazing, that sort of immersive thing where you kind of swoop through the doors and the music's getting louder. That was brilliant. And all the sort of the archive footage and all the celebrities and that, it felt so hedonistic and you felt like you were there and you wanted to have been born, you know, whatever, 20 years earlier. But then, you know, obviously the second half, it sort of turns into more of a kind of, you know, tale of its downfall and a bit of a sort of procedural, and it gets a little bit bogged down in kind of, you know, tax evasion for my liking. And I just found that a little bit, you know, it's sort of less fun in the second half. And it's like, you know, it's like, you watch anything about Al Capone, it's like, you know, you want the sort of the fun gangstery murder stuff. You don't want the accountant going through his books and bringing him down. Do you know what I mean?
True. Although it is literally a downer, because you see this amazing sort of, you know, beautiful multicolored thing sunk by something as mundane as failure to file your tax reports. Oh, and leaving piles of drugs around the club and forgetting to clean them up. But what surprised me was that the movie didn't go for the kind of, you know, what the obvious take you might imagine would be, was it? And, you know, straight society just couldn't take this. It was too beautiful. They were too out there, and straight society resolved to destroy them. It was like, no, you didn't pay your taxes. Yeah. If you don't pay your taxes, your club's going to get closed. If you hadn't been so, you know, overreached yourself so much, you might still have, you know.
Well, maybe that was straight society's way of getting its revenge. I mean, there was a sense, I think, of sort of jealousy about it from other club owners, and from and the media kind of turned on Studio 54 culture very quickly. I like the fact that it wasn't a celebrity talking head documentary.
Yeah.
You know, I think Nile Rodgers pops up once, and that's kind of about it.
Yeah.
There's, you know, that you see old footage of Michael Jackson, Diana Ross, and Liza Minnelli, and there's a brilliant shot of Elton John kind of grabbing Divine's boobs and stuff, but it's not. It's like the inside
story. That was before
story.
He was gay, so it was edgy then. Before he was gay. Yes.
Before everyone was gay. Yes.
So it's kind of, yeah, so it's kind of, you know, it's like kind of like a widescreen version of a kind of Friday night BBC 4 documentary in many ways.
Yeah. What did you think, Sean?
I really enjoyed it. You say there's original footage, which is really amazing. There's this footage of Michael Jackson, who's just, you know, on his off-the-wall period, then. So this is real, raw Michael. And he's obviously sitting in their rubbishy little office, and maybe the disco is happening at the time, it's just about to happen. Mm. And you see him so natural and talking about how great it is to be there and how comfortable he is. And this is the pre-Michael Jackson fall as well. To see that vintage footage, I thought was incredible and really honest, and that they had that. I really enjoyed the film. I thought it was indicative of that period. And they set it up at the start. This is, you know, our rise, but we're also going to show you the fall. That's what Ian Schrager says at the beginning. It went horribly, horribly wrong. So you know it's going to have that dip. But to see that America we don't often see the way that sort of class is constructed or people move through things in that honest way. Steve Rebell, who was the Derek Blasberg of his time. You know, he's the big party guy. He was from a middle-class family that moved upper class because he played tennis. And he got in with the tennis lot and things like that. To see the origin of how people create this amazing thing, I thought was really interesting, the social document bit. Yeah.
I also really like the fact that it's a buddy movie, and one of the buddies isn't around anymore. Yeah. And you can, you know, Rubel was this kind of uncontrollable party guy, just wanted to have everybody to have a good time. Gay Brooklynite, wanted to know everybody, you know, kind of.
He did know everybody.
Proudly shallow. And Schrager, his mate, is the straight guy in every sense. He's the business guy. And later on in the movie, without spoilers, we learn that Schrager's got quite a bit of background in this sort of thing, quite a bit of background, in a way that you wouldn't necessarily want to argue with Schrager. But it's so poignant to see how he genuinely misses his old mate. And, you know, this is apparently the first time he's properly talked about Studio 54. He clearly had that unusual thing, a second act. Ian Schrager hotels they're bigger than Studio 54. They make more money. Not necessarily the cultural impact, but they
might
are.
Not be as fun.
Might not be as fun, but the degree to which, I mean, he clearly knows that they screwed it up for themselves. They were not targeted and brought down by the man. It's like it was their own kind of impetuosity and greed, and he really, really misses his mate. And I think it has all of the elements of a great tragedy to it, because we see them at their great height and we see
it's kind of like a love story in some ways. I just love some of the. You know, the mundane details were brilliant, like the bin bags full of dollar bills and, you know, I had 90 grand's worth of money in bin bags in a sort of false ceiling.
Yeah.
Just because they were, what was it, they had the brilliant mob lawyer, sort of fixer, who was kind of going,
Roy
we
Cohen.
skim off 10% normally. These guys will skim off 80% of the take every night. And they just didn't know where to put the money. They were just shoving it behind radiators.
Someone who used to run a notable club in the north of England that shall remain nameless said that they were so excited at the end of every evening. But a great pitch of excitement. What they do is they get all the money and they sort of like line the banknotes up roughly in a line between two bricks, squeeze it as tightly as they could, estimate where the middle roughly was, then go, right, that's your lot, that's my lot. Let's get back to the party. You know, that's accounting in the world of clubbing, and I'm sure it wasn't all that different in Studio 54. Mm. You know, you don't get your VAT receipts, do you?
And Steve Rebell is going around sort of handing out kind of quaaludes and stuff. And there was the glimpses, sort of tantalising glimpses of these kind of like ledgers of like who had what drugs and sort of what, you know, what people's
which
riders were.
Which his mum was doing the accounts for, which is even better. Yeah. She's the accountant.
It's like, you know, Bianca Jagger doesn't have to pay and she has to have complimentary poppers all evening. And then, yes, you know, and so-and-so has cocaine and so-and-so has quaaludes.
And he has a very big fur coat and all the drugs are in it, apparently,
yeah,
which is amazing.
And that brilliant detail
image
as well in the Stones that, like, Mick and Keith got in free and the other Stones had to pay. I thought
it was
just brilliant.
I love that. That's interesting because one of the, you know, I think one of the it was sort of reasonable reasons to not totally praise Studio 54, the place to the skies, is that it was absolutely the citadel of snobbery. It was you're in, you're out. It
yeah,
was
but that's club culture. That's Steve Strange at Blitz. I don't see that. You
but
can
that's
extricate
not
that from
my
club
culture because
I
think that's what Acid House knocked over. Everybody could get in. You didn't have
to be
in
no
what
slow dance
alley
at the end. That's what's yeah there. And the equality. That's when it really happened. There's a glimpse into my teenage years.
Yeah, that's it. It was, yeah. Basically, I wouldn't have got in. So that's the bit that I object to.
I see.
Yeah.
But they do have footage of those 80-year-old disco grands who got in all the
they
time.
Yeah.
It wasn't that rich people got in or famous people got in all the time.
It was weird people got in.
Yes.
Yeah,
which I always think is a good idea, but there you go.
It is an ongoing injustice and ridiculous thing, isn't it, that disco is still seen as a bit of a joke.
That just really, really annoys me.
It really,
I
really
get
annoys
angry
me.
Even hearing the words disco sucks, that whole movement.
Yeah.
Look at those idiots not dancing. What is wrong with them?
Yeah, in their crap clothes, their crap hair.
Yeah, and I don't think that.
And the crap records that nobody listens to anymore.
I just don't think that it could have lasted any longer because of the backlash.
Mm.
And neither should it, I suppose.
But this idea that, like, you sort of see it represented in, like, sort of broad popular culture is like, hey, it's a girl in a rainbow afro doing a peace sign with a CND sign around her neck. Disco. The 70s, which apparently is the same as the late 1960s. You know, that really gets on my nerves, the idea that disco is just the soundtrack to this sort of, you know, sort of novelty record.
That's right, but when you actually listen to Sylvester or listen to at the end, they played, this isn't a spoiler, but they played Young Hearts Run Free, and, you know, you won't get a better song.
Well, it's as well as it being the kind of music of, you know, gay America actualizing itself, it's also the music of Black America being upwardly mobile after, you know, however many years being kept down, and you know, that you actually can actually take the sort of consumerist route to satisfaction. It's socially interesting and important.
It's the sound of freedom.
It is the sound of freedom. I think we should just play a little disco records for the rest of the show, but we can't. Let's have a bit of different music. We always ask our guests to bring in a tune. Hannah Verdier, what have you brought in for us?
Oh, well, I had a little trip out to Field Day last week, and as well as Erykah Badu, I saw Loyal Carner, who I'd never actually seen live before. He's 23, he's from South London. And so my favourite song there was No CD.
OK, we're going to have a listen to it. Hannah Verdier is a total clear loyalist here. This is Loyal Carner and No CD.
My OCD won't let me keep it. I never speak it and keep it a secret. It'd be peak if any geezer would hear it and then repeat it. So we keep it deep and out of reach from all the Egypts. If you need it, best believe it, you won't seek it. Locked up in my room, deep cocoon, like you're digging in crates. Already dug where you're digging, so you're digging is bait. Keeping it straight, buzz until late, sample the breaks. Then we move on to the groove, grabbing that sample at 8 seconds. Loop beckon, smooth like new weapons. If I do step in, slew.
Now, Kanye West is back. News which will either make you leap for Yeezus or have you running towards that off button. Although there's never an off button anymore on anything, is there? America's most visible narcissist has taken a break from tweeting in praise of Donald Trump and that hat to release a tight 23-minute album entitled Yay. It's the reverse of 2016's bloated Life of Pablo. In the old days, we'd call it an EP. What's he gone and done this time? Does Kanye's public persona overshadow the music? And, recurring theme on the show, at what point does an artist become so personally repellent you can't listen to their music anymore? We're going to talk about it after this track.
Tweaking, tweaking off that 2CB, huh? Is he gonna make it TBD, huh? Daughter's gonna run, DMC, huh? I done died and lived again on DMT, huh? See, this the type of high that won't come down. This the type of high that get you gunned down. Yeezy, easy trolling OD, huh? Turn TMZ to smack DVD, huh? Russell Simmons wanna pray for me too. I'ma pray for him cause he got me too. Thinking what if that happened to me too? Then I'm on E! News.
Yikes. That was Yikes by Kanye West from Ye. Sometimes I scare myself, you and us both, mate. Hannah Verdier. This starts with one of the most startling tracks imaginable. I Thought About Killing You, which must be lovely for Kim Kardashian to hear, mustn't it?
What the hell
is going on? Isn't that track is actually flat out revolting, isn't it?
It is, yes. I'm finding this quite hard to defend because I do love Kanye West, and I think this album, I don't know why he put it out. It's just more ammunition for people who don't understand him and hate him. Hmm. He's not going to win himself any friends in those 23 minutes.
But he's never wanted to win friends. What he wants to do is spill his guts, doesn't he?
I think maybe making a better album that's slightly more musical would have been a good idea. But yeah, that first one, he's telling us more than we need to know.
Well, he just sort of rambles on. Like, you only care enough to kill someone you truly love.
But he loves himself more, so yeah. He's not going to do it.
The most beautiful thoughts are always beside the darkest. I think this is... And then, I think this is the part where I'm supposed to say something good to compensate so it doesn't come off bad. This is the sort of thing you find in a lot of hand-scribbled notes for someone who's just been done for doing a school shooting or something. It's horrible.
It's so horrible. And I actually thought it had livened up halfway through, but it was just my Spotify going on to old Kanye in a random style. I was like, oh, this one's all right.
Exactly the same thing happened to me as well.
Yeah. It's like, oh, thanks. That was just
this
the
album suddenly cheered up.
That's the intro.
A different album. It's a different album, yeah. What did you make of it as a piece of musical entertainment?
I don't think it was entertaining enough. I quite like Ghost Town, and I quite liked All Mine because it got a bit falsetto and it showed his skill of just being able to spill out the lines. But other than that, I think if he'd have mixed it with good tracks, they would have been okay as fillers, but I don't think it stands alone, and I'd have waited until I'd have recorded a bit more if I was him.
Yeah. What about you, Michael? What did you think of it?
Similar. I mean, it does sound like, you know, the cover is... It's a sort of shot of a mountain that he apparently took with his iPhone on the way to the album launch.
Yeah, I don't believe
that. No, me neither. But it's got "I Hate Being Bipolar, It's Awesome" written on it in kind of green crayon over the top of it.
We've all been on deadline, yeah. But really.
Does it say I hate or I like being bipolar? Because I did a little tongue
punch. I hate, and then it's awesome. You know, that's it. It's like, you know.
Yeah. Get it? It's like Ken
Dodd. Oh, I see.
Yeah. Ken Dodd joke.
But it's kind of the sound of a man's mental breakdown in a way. And you're right, it has got a feeling of sort of unfinishedness about it. It feels like sort of notes for an album rather than an album. It's kind of, there's some of the lyrics sound like kind of almost a sung and kind of half-heartedly, like a sort of guide track for where the lyric will go eventually when someone sings properly. There's bits where he kind of mumbles deliberately like he hasn't written a rhyme there yet. Yeah. And it does feel like it's like handing in your first draft of an album. Mm. It's got some good bits on it. I mean, I think there's three or four songs on there that are pretty good and wouldn't seem out of place on a proper album, but the whole thing is just a little bit painful to listen to. It's very mumbly, very sparse, very soul bearing. You know, he talks about Kim a lot. He sort of refers to his own mental health struggles. He talks about his daughter. It's just a bit much. It's kind of like Kanye on the couch, and you know, maybe sort of medical privilege should have applied, and we shouldn't have to listen to all of it.
I mean, it is brave to the extent that he's kind of exposes so much about himself that is very, very unattractive. Mm. But this is what he's always done. You wonder how much of it is kind of bravery and commitment and how much of it is just a total, absolute lack of filter and an all-consuming narcissism which assumes that absolutely everybody in the world is interested in every impulse of everything that's ever gone on in Kanye West's brain.
I don't mind that. Mm. I think that's how a pop star should be.
Yeah, I don't mind him being eccentric and an egomaniac and all that kind of thing. You know, you're absolutely right. That's what pop stars are. It'd be very boring if everyone was kind of, you know, went to the Brit school and spouted media platitudes. Yeah. But he's not a sort of likeable eccentric, and the music kind of isn't good enough to justify the kind of the nastier sides of it. Yeah. I don't think.
And also, it's impossible to separate the record from the ongoing social media Kanye West drama. The news cycle and the record cycle are one, and he does seem to be having this narcissistic implosion at the moment. Tweeting that slavery is a choice, standing up for Trump, and more and more it seems like he is basically Trump. He's, you know, nothing matters as long as all eyes are on him, willing to do anything that as long as he's in the spotlight. And yet, for years we've said, well, pop stars are so dull and so boring. Well, you wanted an insane pop star, you've got one now, and it seems to repel and horrify everyone.
Mm. No, he's clearly unwell in some ways, and it's just
he is.
And some of his records have been amazing. This isn't one of them.
Yeah.
And we do want pop stars to be larger than life, but, you know, I don't remember David Bowie putting out an album that was like kind of mumbling notes for an album. You know,
no, although
these things would arrive fully formed and shiny and brilliant.
Yeah, but something like Station to Station was definitely a brain dump of his personal madness at the time.
It was Station better. To Station is good.
Yes, and that's why it was good. And that's, it's clearly brilliant.
Yes, but it's musical. And what I think is that we're confusing the product. The product is Kanye the person in the tweets. This is just something alongside.
Is it a brand extension?
Yes. I mean, this is just, you know, the hobby. This is him tinkering in the shed. He tweeted that all seven tracks are the top seven on Apple and Spotify at the moment. So that's this week. So you can make, if you're Kanye, you can make any sound you want. You could burp into the microphone. That's an album. Yeah. You're still going to be number one. People are going to read your tweets. They're going to talk about you. So it's almost as if the product, as I say, is interchangeable with the person. So it doesn't matter. However, he is a deeply disturbed man, needs more therapy if he's getting any at all. And yes, I'm a little bit worried about him.
Yeah.
You know, he talks, he's really nasty about women. And we can't say that he's not. Talks about taking former girlfriends to the titty shop.
Yeah.
No, I don't. Yes, he's a pop star. That's great.
Treat.
But it doesn't warm me to him.
Yeah. He talks about kind of having threesomes with his wife and someone else as well.
Yeah, it's a bit, I don't really want to know.
Yeah.
Could you not have put that out?
Well, yeah. That's not a new thing for him either, is it? He's always had a little bit of the misogyny about him.
But there's a lovely line, there's lines in Goldigger, and I really like Goldigger, where he's talking about this woman taking him and other people for a ride. But there's a bit where he says, and I still love her. There's a warmth to it. There's something of, you know, he's conflicted. Here he's not conflicted. He's bipolar and he thinks it's brilliant. Because he's a superhero and he's got bipolar. He's turned the negatives into the positives and they don't make sense.
I think there are some positives in here that makes it difficult to just dismiss him as a total, you know, as a write-off and a nightmarish human being. I mean, on the one hand, he's, you know, there's lines like, I know I'm sensitive, I've got a gentle mental. Every time something happened, they want to want me sentimental, i.e., you know, I am, you know, I'm not a horrendous human being, but I just can't control it. And then a few lines later, it's Russell Simmons want to pray for me too, and pray for him because he got me too'd. So like, oh, so you're standing up for like the people who are being had up for years and decades of groping women, are you? It just makes you go, ugh. There's an awful lot of ugh on this record.
There is.
And yet, on the track, Wouldn't Leave, he actually talks about that thing where he seemed to defend slavery.
Yeah.
And the track is like, now I'm on a million blogs, my wife is screaming at me, I've destroyed everything, I've ruined our lives, it's all my fault, all because of my big mouth. It's like you are looking into an open-air kind of spectator insane asylum.
His wife says, though, I think, which is slightly revealing, she says, my wife's screaming, we're going to lose it all.
Yeah.
So all he cares about is, you know, the wealth and the money. It's nothing to do with it.
I don't know about that. Well, I mean, it's almost impossible to put yourself in the place of someone like those two, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, it's not a normal life, is it?
No. Well, in previous decades, you've been able to, you know, sort of imagine what it would be like to be, you know, Bob Dylan or John Lydon or James Brown or Prince or any one of a number of major pop stars. They were living a life.
I'll
more
be Prince, please. Is that a choice?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Prince. Yeah,
probably
great
Bob
one.
Dylan. Have we got any women in there?
I'll be Petula Clark.
Hashtag patriarchy.
Or Dusty Springfield, for that matter. But I don't think anybody can place themselves mentally where Kanye West is. Why would you want to?
Oh, you wouldn't want to be him at all, would
he
you?
He says as well, doesn't him? He say, I don't take advice from anyone less successful than
yes,
me
I,
as well.
Yes, I
Yeah,
which is a charming thing to say.
That's no...
But success in what form, Kanye?
Well, exactly, yeah.
You know.
At what point... Well, Charming, did you enjoy this record at all?
I almost did. I quite like the first track. He seems to just ramble through it. It's not that scripted.
You quite like the first track where he threatens to murder his wife?
He doesn't say his wife. It could be someone that he hasn't got on with, could be a former manager, because I went back and I re-listened to it. He doesn't say his wife.
That's
he
people projecting their Kardashian hatred onto it.
So he's saying that he might murder someone. That I quite enjoyed that. And musically, I quite liked it. Some of it is all over the place musically. You've got one song starts and another one finishes. And I also think this is in the line of the blues. This is Jimi Hendrix can sing Manic Depression. And we go, yeah, that's great. But are we able to accept Kanye having Manic Depression, which is now called bipolar?
But...
I did enjoy bits of it.
Under any other circumstances, you would say the artist is playing a role, they are fulfilling, it's like an actor. And that's absolutely fine. But it's impossible to extricate the public figure of Kanye West from what he sings about. And I don't think he is acting.
No, I don't think
acting. None of this is I'll inhabit a character. Oh, I'm King Lear.
I feel sorry for him. I think he needs some actual proper help.
And there's some tunes on it, though. I mean, you know, Ghost Town's very good. And I like No Mistakes. I thought that was really good. It was like a bit like early Kanye, proper Kanye. Had that sort of you know, had some sort of soul samples on it and kept piano chords and a little bit of, you know, falsetto. The kind of middle section of the album's good.
Yeah.
But it's sort of sandwiched between these kind of sort of mumbly mentalist confessionals, yeah, which are quite hard to like or listen to.
At what point do we say we've had enough of you, hip-hop Morrissey, and turn away in shame?
I'm going to keep going, because also, if he's going through some things, I don't think he's there to be mocked. Mm. I don't know in any other walk of life whether we'd go, oh, hello, you're mental.
Yeah. This goes back to my fame should be banned theory. Yeah. That at a point it actually should be banned, and you know, mental health experts will say it's no good for anyone. It just really isn't helping him out at the moment.
As a class A controlled substance. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move on, for God's sake. Yeah. If you like Big Mouth, can we interest you in another podcast that we're putting together with the high-end Danish loudspeaker manufacturer Dali? It's called Be There with Dali, and it ties in with a new print magazine that's also called Be There. They're both about the backroom talents and studio geniuses behind legendary recordings. In the first issue, we talk to the game-changing rock producer John Leckie about everything from Pink Floyd to Radiohead. We look at five records that definitively changed recording, and Jude Rogers meets the most in-demand woman in the mixing business, the extraordinary Marta Solonyi. You can get the first episode of Be There with Dali on the Big Mouth Facebook page or at audioboom.com/channels/be-there. Or just search for it by name in the Apple Podcast Store. Here's a clip of journalist and past Big Mouth guest James Medd talking about Toe Rag Studios, where rock and roll went back to basics.
He's a producer, and he's famous as for running a studio that recorded in 60s style. You know, effectively, he's considered to be a Luddite. Eight tracks, everyone recording at the same time, minimal overdubs. That's, as I learned, not quite the truth. Mm-hmm. But he certainly started his studio with old equipment, a lot of it from Abbey Road. Mm. I guess what he changed, he introduced a strand of music. I think there were other people doing it again in America, recording like this. But when he recorded Elephant with the White Stripes, he managed to produce a number one record in 2003 that was recorded on eight tracks and sounded at least as good as anything, any other rock record produced at the time.
We talked about this just before the show. I re-listened to Elephants, which is a record I'm pretty familiar with, but not through the best speakers. I listened to them on the, I think, the Rubicons. And, you know, you hear people talk about you can really hear the room. On this, you can absolutely hear every atom in the room. It's quite astonishing. I mean, Meg White is not the world's technically most gifted drummer, but while she's walloping a snare, you can not just hear the kind of sympathetic vibration in wires on the snare and stuff. You can hear the stands on the cymbals. You can hear the shimmer of the cymbal in this sympathetic whack.
And from one rather fragile pop star who spills it all out on their records and their socials to Lily Allen. The former carefree London girl about town has been through the mill in the last few years. She got divorced. She lost interest in her own music. She had to face up to her substance issues, apparently. It's generally been a bad time. And the roasting that her previous album, Jesus, received for cultural appropriation didn't help. So how does her fourth album, No Shame, deal with all of that? Here's one of the new tracks. This is Trigger Bang with special guest Geek. And it fuels my addiction. Hanging out in this whirlwind. If you cool my ambitions, I'm gonna cut you out. That's why I can't hang with the cool yet. Everyone's a trigger. Bang, 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 bang. Goodbye, bad bones. I've got big plans. Gonna put myself in your hands. When I was young, I was blameless. Playing with rude boys and trainers. I had a foot in... Lily Allen with Trigger Bang from No Shame. Hannah Verdier, where do you stand on Lily Allen? Are you a fan of hers?
I haven't been in the past, apart from maybe Smile and The Fear, but this album, I put it on thinking, oh, hello, here's going to be a weak white vocalist. I'm sorry to say that, but it's not my thing. And I was amazed by it. I thought it was great.
Wow.
I think it's really confessional. It had me... Sorry, I sound really hormonal here, but it had me in tears halfway through. And I think she has had a roasting. I think it's complete double standards the way she's been treated. And I think she is, as a whole, a brilliant pop star, and she's talented. And she's hard on herself in this, far too hard on herself. And, yeah, I really don't know where to start with it. I think Family Man, which is a slightly Oasis one, is one of the best things she's ever done. It's really confessional. She's saying you can kind of see her life through it. I think the family man is her.
Yeah.
But I could be wrong. And she's saying, I need my time away from you. And
she did say that she started writing in 2015. This is one of the first songs. Mm. So it's been quite a long inception, the whole thing. What about the honesty of the record? Because that's honest. But, I mean, we get some quite lurid details.
We do, yes. And I think it's a good thing. Because I know we've been talking a bit about honesty. And if people were sitting there being not very authentic making this music, then they'd be criticised for that. But she lays everything out. I think the worst one for me where it really got me is 3, where she's talking about life from her child's perspective and how she's always out on tour and never sees her. And I think she is just being a bit hard on herself, because I think now we live in a culture where parents are supposed to be there and never go out and earn any money. And I think she's feeling the pressure of that.
There's a great line on the opening track. I think it was one of the early singles, Come On Then. And she's talking about being crying all night and being on her own. And she sings, I'm a bad mother. And like, not in the Samuel L. Jackson sense. And the sort of jokes and the sort of self-protecting humour that she used to hide under layer upon layer of that, there's still a bit of it, but it's mostly pretty naked, isn't it?
Yes. I'm looking over into middle distance there. Michael Hogan, what did you think of it?
I liked it. I'm a big fan of Lily Allen. I think she's a great thing. This is kind of like her kind of kitchen sink album. It's kind of quite sort of low-key and confessional and honest and raw and heartbreaking. And really, you know, really sweet and likeable and brilliant. There's Mark Ronson's contributed to it, the guy Ezra from Vampire Weekend as well. There's lots of sort of stripped back ballads. There's, you know, her voice seems to be getting higher as she gets older. There's lots of that sort of fluttery, kind of high pitched voice that she does, which is rather lovely to listen to. And there's some tunes on it, you know. Unlike Kanye's album, which we've just been talking about, it, you know, this is confessional as well, but it's a lot more likeable, and it's got some bangers on it, which Kanye's sort of lacks. And the lyrics are, as you say, very funny and very, very honest. There's talking about, you know, I'm a bad mother, I'm a bad wife. You saw it on the socials, you saw it online. Mm. She sort of talks about the media coverage of it. There's a lot of maternal guilt on there. There's, you know, there's not often you get a song about colouring in and making papier-mâché fish, because she talks about how she's never around to do those things with her daughters, which is, you know, extraordinary. I think it's a really admirable piece of work.
And what you were saying there about, you know, the contrast, her confessional approach and Kanye West is, I'm awful, I'm dreadful, so what? And this is genuinely guilty. She feels bad about it. And it is brave to say these things. Because she's not using it in any way as self-aggrandizement the way that Kanye does, I thought.
What about the narcissism element to it? Because I found that someone singing 15 songs about themselves that don't really vary in, I'm talking to you, I'm trying to be really honest, and you're probably my ex-husband. I found that too samey. And I found that so me, it made me turn it off in the middle of it and then have to come back to
but
it.
But there's me, and there's look at me, I'm crap, isn't there?
Are they not?
And also, you've got to write about what you know. She's living in this kind of closed world now. You know, the walls of pop are up around her. She's not running around London doing fun things like she used to do.
But she strikes me as someone who is deeply unhappy. I'm getting a lot of deep unhappiness from this. I'm thinking you're in the wrong job. You could retrain, you could go and do something like this. She's like the person saying,
right, life coach. Yeah,
open university is fine. If you've got a day job, you can do it at night, or vice versa. I just think sometimes that being a pop star isn't, it's not quite the right fit, and it's easy and it's fine, but I get a bit of the unhappy millionaires about it.
Yeah.
Well, actually, just trot off, and you could go and sort of adopt a horse, or you could be the CEO of something exciting. You're quite ballsy. I'm finding the me, and I have sex a lot, and I have sex with people I don't know. I don't really want to know anymore.
I think you're right. I think they could, both Kanye and Lily, in a way, could do with an edit, couldn't they? I mean, the album's too long. There's 14 songs, so it does start to feel very samey.
Yeah, yeah.
If it was like, you know, 10, 12 even, or had another sort of variation of pace or variation of lyrical subject in it, it would be a lot more palatable. I think, you know, that's the one criticism I would have of it, is that it does get a little bit samey. There's 14 tracks about her, about her children, about her guilt, about her love life. And that's as far as
and what people say about her. And I often think, well, if you don't like it, should we all just get off Twitter? Maybe that is a better idea.
Well, that's a bigger recipe for absolutely everybody, that, isn't it? We're all now
this
able
seems a bit
to...
Twitter heavy, this album.
That's the world for a lot of people, isn't it? And I think if there was a big red button on the table here to disinvent social media forever, retrospectively,
ooh,
I'd press it in a trice.
Ooh.
Yeah, I think it's done far more harm than it's done good. far more harm. It's destroyed democracy, for a start. Anything else?
Oh, that old thing.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
There are a few lols on Lily's album. There's some good lines. There's a great line on Apples where she sings, "Do you remember way back when at my old flat we stayed in bed all day having sex and smoking fags?" I thought that's like Kathy Burke hip hop there. I like that quite much.
Ooh, and that made scowling. Me do, that was my Dame Edna face. I was like, yeah, all right.
I was
sex,
worried they
great.
Hadn't had a wash all day, and it made me feel a bit uncomfortable.
But she's looking back on what she used to be like and wondering and understanding that it's turned into what she is now, which is a very unhappy person. It's not like, wasn't it great in the good old days when I was riding around on my bike, you know?
Oh, yeah, we like those days.
We like those ones, but it's made her into what she is now, which is a very unhappy person.
But that's not why she's unhappy.
She's got a witty turn of phrase in lyrics, yes, undoubtedly. You know, even when she's being sad, there's, you know, I'm going to put that loser in an Uber and stuff like that.
Yeah,
you
know?
And but you're right, the overall impression of is that fame isn't much fun.
It should be banned.
Yeah, it made me feel really sorry for her, actually. I mean, I found it an entertaining album. I thought it sounded great, actually. I think the sound is very different. They've got away from that sort of Euro radio pop thing. There's more hip hop. There's more kind of dancehall-y bits in there. It's more strange electronic. It felt like a very summery British R&B album. And what you were saying about her voice not being a capital S singer voice, I think it fits really well with this sound because it feels like a real human being inhabiting this big world.
I think it works better here than in a John Lewis cover version style. That's what I was dreading. And then this was a really nice surprise.
But I think we do have a cultural problem where people like Lily Allen statistically don't sell that many records. And so she has to make money through doing adverts and doing touring and maybe sponsoring this, that and the other or wearing someone's clothes. How does that then impact on the art that you're making? You probably think, well, the art's not much cop, but at least I can make some money, you know, playing some festivals. I think that has a real impact on what people are doing. It's the Kanye thing. Your Twitter feed is more famous than you. Is that not a problem long term for artists?
It probably gives you more freedom, though, because if you made the best album in the world, it wouldn't be the best selling, would it? So if it's not much cop, she's probably put her heart and soul into this and made a really good product. If it doesn't sell, then she can carry on making those records. Yeah. And the Twitter stuff and the sponsorship or whatever will enable her to do that, which is a good thing.
I mean, four
creative freedom.
Four albums for an artist like this is pretty good going. I mean, when she came through the pop route, I think it's her best record, actually. I think it's the one that really surprised me more than anything. We can disagree, Sian, it's all right.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm sure she's a nice lady.
Did you like her in the first place?
No, not really. Mm. And I don't mind if she... You know, she can do what she wants. She can go and take some drugs, sleep with some people. And, you know, obviously, I am not the arbiter of what she does.
You're not the Daily Mail, are you?
Just wish sometimes she'd sing from the point of view of a rabbit or a cake. Or she sings about cake, but it wasn't that the cake song I quite wanted.
Didn't she sing from the point of view of a rabbit in that John Lewis ad?
Yeah, look at that there, yeah. Okay, let's have a bit more music in a different vein. Michael Hogan, it's your turn. What tune have you brought in for The Clash?
I brought in Work My Mind by Cut Chemist, who is, for those who don't know who he is, he's Lucas McFadden is his real name. He's a former member of Jurassic 5, very good hip-hop band, and their kind of Latin salsa-y party band spin-off, Oz and Matley. He's collaborated with DJ Shadow, Black Alicia's Roots Maneuver. He's a cool guy. And he's released his first album in 12 years. He's been spending the last sort of decade doing loads of producing and collaboration, but his new album, Die Cut, is really, really good. And this is the kind of the big banger on it. It's called Wet My Mind. It reminds me slightly of kind of Q-Tip. It's got that kind of hip house, kind of funky energy. And it was recently on the soundtrack to one of my favourite TV shows, Silicon Valley. And it features Charlie Tuna from Jurassic 5, who's got that lovely sort of baritone fast flow. And it's great.
Here we go. It's the all-night Cut Chemist, Work My Mind.
Turn it around when I'm burning it down. Permanent furnace, the tournament's engulfed in the cloud of black smoke. Relax, folks, it's urban the town. I'm determined to tell my government no vermin allowed. New owner in town, in my zone, I'm endowed with a special set of skills that can level the crowd. Telling you devilish clowns ain't no rolling allowed, but now the only turn it up instead of toning it down. Time to start the revolution, and the moment is now. We can spark an education if I throw in the towel. I get nose when the growl, when to go on the prowl, when to go in for the killing by the hole in the cow. Hold it down, speed it up instead of slowing it down. Immediately heat it up and keep it low to the ground.
Work My Mind by Cut Chemist, as chosen by Michael Hogan. Now, we're going to do one of our periodic confessionals. There's always something out there that you think you ought to like. Everybody seems to love it. All the people you love and respect are into it. And it seems like really good fun. But try as you might, you can't get into it. So we're going to discover the thing I wish I liked, but I don't, from our guests. And here, as a taster, is what they've chosen.
Tonight I'm loose and fancy free. With the action, I just know it's time to go.
A medley of things we wish we liked, but we just don't. Some terrible taste crimes there. That was ABBA with Summer Night City, then the Game of Thrones theme, then AC/DC with A Whole Lot of Rosie, and finally the theme from The Magnificent Seven. Now, who had ABBA? I'm looking at you, Verdier.
Guilty as charged.
How can this be? How dare you? How can you say you don't like ABBA?
I know. As a diehard pop fan, everyone just assumes I'm going to love ABBA. With apologies to my friend who's in the Mamma Mia musical. I hope she doesn't hear this.
Yeah.
I just can't get on with them. I mean, I know, my mind knows that the songs are good, their stories, the songwriting is excellent, they're legendary, the melodies are amazing, but my ears just don't like them. Apart from Gimme Gimme Gimme, but the rest of them, if I hear Dancing Queen, it just plods onto the dance floor. It's just not for
That's
me.
That's the most euphoric record ever made, and with a heartbreaking lyric. How can I just...
I know this. My mind knows this, but my ears don't.
Have you nailed down what it is you don't like about them, or is it a mystery to you yourself?
It really is a mystery. I think, if I had to say, it might be the production of it all. It's just a slight bit too laid back for me.
Yeah?
You put a wall of sound on there, I might be in business. But...
Funny you should say wall of sound, because I watched one of those kind of Sky Arts documentaries last night about ABBA,
right,
which happened to be on, including Will Hodgkinson, past guest and friend of the show. And they went into some detail about how early ABBA really was wall of sound. And when you listen to things like Ring Ring and Waterloo, they don't sound all that different from the kind of reinvented kind of, the glammed up rock and roll that, you know, David Bowie and Roxy Music were doing at the time. It's really kind of brash.
I have my hand up. I don't like ABBA either.
How can you not like ABBA?
I find it's very high, so they sing very high, the ladies.
Is that hard for you to join in with?
I find it hard on the ears. They are notoriously difficult to sing, those songs. The melodies are up and down. Yeah. I mean, there's octaves and octaves and octaves.
Alan Partridge struggled with them.
When I hear them, there's a similar thing with the Carpenters as well. I just want to run a mile. There's a squeakiness and there's a kind of life is rosy and yet it's tinged with, no, go away! Well, I find very, very difficult to listen to. So I am with Hannah.
Well, you know, that's fine.
I am no dancing queen.
But I don't understand, you know, tears on the toilet, tears on the dance floor is amazing when it's New Order or the Pet Shop Boys or Robin.
Yeah. Yeah.
But not when it's ABBA? Come on.
Exactly.
It's the same thing. They invented it, for God's sake.
I know, I'm a hypocrite here.
Well, this is an irrational section, you know. We're not going to try and persuade you to change your mind, but it's astonishing. Now, moving on to Game of Thrones. Hogan, this is you. Why do you not get on with the Game of the Thrones?
Well, I should like it. And I write about TV for a living, really. And it's one of the biggest TV dramas in the world. It's much loved. It's a huge thing. It's made by HBO. It's got a great cast. Blah, blah. But make it
put that on the back of the DVD.
I've never been able to get into it. It's just like, it reminds me of the sort of nerdy kids at school playing Dungeons and Dragons. It's sort of kind of hobbity.
All right.
And kind of,
right,
you know.
Boobs and dragons.
To be like that. Yeah.
And it's, you know, and then people say, it's really sexy. It's a classic sort of sex position thing. Do you know the sex position phenomena? So you'll get two male characters in the foreground, kind of like moving the plot along, and there'll just be some boobs and some humping wandering around in the background, just to keep us interested.
But back to Position of the Fortnight, King's Landing.
And
yes,
you know, although it's po-faced and the dialogue's really pompous.
Oh, it's not po-faced.
And people
it's
are
really
in,
funny.
It's just like people are in fancy dress.
It's
and. I can't get on with
it. I'll give you all of those things, but I will not have that as po-faced. It's so funny. There's a great bit in the middle of most horrendous battle you'll ever see. And one of the characters says, if they had less troops here, we'd win. And his adjutant, Sir Davos Seaworth, says, fewer. In the middle of a battle. You know, yeah, that's funny.
Right. And
that's
it's not funny. Geeky at all then.
That's not geeky. That's getting things right.
Oh,
that's
right, Verdi. No, I'm in agreement with you there. I just think all that, let's strip off some women and have a bit of rumpity while there's a battle going on. It's a bit
I've
hashtag
never seen
me
it.
Too for me.
I've never seen it. I'm so happy.
Well,
I've seen about 5 minutes, so what do I know?
Well, actually, there's a serious point there, the idea that it's kind of, it's a bit me too. Well, it's creating a medieval world which is violent, enormously sexist, manipulative and values life very cheaply indeed. So we can't judge it by the mores of now. You know, this is a world where we don't worry about the lives of poor people and sex workers. We just treat them as chattels. That's what the world of this show is.
So it's okay to show that and have loads of people celebrating it.
Well, it's okay. It's clearly okay to show thousands of people being killed in horrendous circumstances. We wouldn't think that was a good thing, would we? We wouldn't think that was admirable. It's part of the world of the show. And to deny that it's got a very brutal attitude to human life and sexuality would be to deny the reality of the show. That is my case, my love.
I don't like anything that needs a map at the beginning. Do you know what I mean? you know, it's like those Tolkien books with a big map of Middle Earth. It's like, bugger off with your maps. I don't want a map. And Game of Thrones credit sequence is very good, but it's a massive map. You know, and it's kind of basically saying, you need loads of knowledge to get through this world. There's too many characters in it. It's slightly impenetrable. And when you do get into it, there's going to be loads of people wandering around in sort of furs and dragons and dwarves and magic.
So it's a bit like real life history then, where there's too many characters and there's not enough narrative. Get lost, Wars of the Roses. We're not interested in you.
Can I just say two words? Wig budget. Just looks like that to me. When I think someone's got a high wig budget count, I just don't want to watch it.
And yet, the wig budget on the Pet Shop Boys performance tour, you were fine with that, and yet you're not fine with
it. No, I need them to account to me on that.
I love Game of Thrones. I do. I think it's brilliant.
You do, don't you?
I find it very exciting, and I understand the criticism you made of it.
But what don't you love, Andrew Harrison?
Well,
tell
us. Glad you asked me that. AC/DC. We played a whole lot of Rosie there. I have tried and tried and tried with AC/DC. Everybody thinks they're fantastic. Everybody's got a very sound set of reasons. It's unpretentious. It's good, you know, get your hands dirty, rock and roll. It's not trying to pretend something that it isn't. Widely loved by everyone. And I just listen to it and it leaves me absolutely cold. Maybe because I just don't like loud guitars very much. I just, you know, I find it lump and brutal and pointless. I don't understand. You know, there's this argument that people go, well, you know, people criticise Oasis for making the same record over and over again, but they never criticise AC/DC for making the same record over and over again. Apparently that's brilliant. Well, I bloody do. I criticise them for making the same record over and over again. I just don't understand the point of it. I never had a metal phase in my youth, and it's probably a bit late for one now. So perhaps I'm lacking that emotional connection with it, that idea of jumping up and down in a sweaty room and a load of blokes in battle jackets never particularly appealed to me. But I've literally listened to a lot of AC/DC records going, come on, you're going to get it now. It's going to come through. Friend of the show, Justin Quirk, was on here a while ago, and he's saying, you've got to look at them, Andrew, as if they're Kraftwerk. They have boiled this music down to its essence, and they repeat that essence over and over again. Intellectually, I get that. I just don't want to bloody listen to it.
No, they're the Game of Thrones of music.
Finally, we listen to the Magnificent Seven theme. Sean, this is you, and the thing you can't get on with is Westerns. Am I right?
Totally. And I have tried. So I got top five Westerns, and I did a run. One and I am going to understand the idea of man, loneliness. I've got a big list. Right, okay. Man choose something, matchstick. Gazes out into distance, Shakespeare. Good versus evil, evil inside, redemption, evil outside. Land, friendship, passion, landscape, ownership, freedom. All the themes, outsiders, insiders. I went through everything. I tried to get into character, and obviously they're all different. No, I can't do it. I just look at Clint Eastwood and I go, no. I look at all the other people in the Magnificent Seven. I go, no. There's something that my brain can't connect with and would really quite like to. I'd really like to get into this idea of how we are. And who we are.
Is it to do with the hat budget? You mentioned the wig budget.
Or the tumbleweed
budget.
She's
like anything to do with heads.
I understand those themes. You could say, intellectually, you could give me the piece of paper that gives me the themes. These are the themes that I've mentioned. I just can't do it, and I quite like to. This is something I quite like to get into and sort of be au fait with.
Is it because it's just like loads of desert and there's not much happening there? There's just a lot of hooves thumping along a dry riverbed.
Well, I was thinking, the people I like, you know, Nico... was still alive, and she was, you know, I really like Nico. If she was in a Western, I still wouldn't like it. If Janelle Monáe directed it and Alan Bennett did the screenplay, I still probably wouldn't like
one
it.
One of her videos basically was a Western.
Yeah, I know.
Midnight Cowboy, I thought, it's the nearest I get. Yeah. Because that's the cowboy into the city. I get that. Maybe I like the city and maybe I just don't like the countryside. And that includes the Western countryside landscape.
You're an urban person, aren't you?
I am an urban person.
Oh, well, I think we conclude this section by saying there's no accounting for taste. So we're coming towards the end of the show, which means closing time chatter, what we're going to be talking about over drinks at the weekend in whatever fancy pants pop-up we're in. Hannah Verdier, what's your closing time chatter?
I've got a new podcast that I love.
Excellent.
One that isn't made by you. And it's called Dead Rock Stars. And I found it absolutely fascinating. The first episode is about Lemmy.
Yes.
And it's Kerrang's Mick Wall and Metal Hammer's Joel McIver talking about pop stars they have known. Sorry, rock stars they have known. And sometimes not known, and what they were really like. And the stories and the way they tell them are amazing.
Well, one thing you can say for The Metal Journalist is they spend an awful lot more time hanging around with the musos than those of us in the world of pop, don't they?
I noticed this, like, when I went round Lemmy's house and he's wearing this costume. I was like, how did you get that access? Did the PR sign that off? Were they in the room?
Yeah,
and it's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't go and hang around in Moby's house for a cup of tea for hours and hours and hours, but there probably wouldn't be much to see, would they? You know? But the metal guys, they stick with the subject for a long time. So it's called Dead Rock Stars, and it's available where fine podcasts are downloaded.
Indeed.
Fantastic. Michael Hogan, what have you got?
I've got two things. Obviously, A Very English Scandal. It has been brilliant. It's just finished last weekend, the Jeremy Thorpe drama.
Yeah. Are you musical?
I think bunnies shall and will win BAFTAs. And the other thing was Father Ted... The musical news, very exciting news last week on Graham Linehan's, he tweeted that he and Arthur Matthews, the co-creators of The Great Father Ted, have almost completed a stage musical with music by Neil Hannon of The Divine Comedy. Mm-hmm. Graham Linehan said it's the real final episode of Father Ted. And asked why he was bringing it back, he said, when Trump won and Corbyn won the Labour leadership, I kind of thought, maybe Ted's got a chance. There's a whole new trend for what's been termed joke box musicals. Because Only Fools and Horses there's a musical opening next year. Right. And weirdly, Goodnight Sweetheart musical is also coming our way.
I hate that show, it gives me the
creeps. I know, but think about it. You can combine sort of, you know, whatever, 90s pop songs. With sort of wartime songs. It's kind of quite clever in a strange way.
In a way that's not very clever.
Yeah. In a kind of shit Gary Sparrow, Nicholas Lindhurst wearing a hat way. Hat budget.
Hat budget out. Joke box musical, you heard it here.
Anyway, Father Ted the musical.
Yeah, Pope Ted apparently it's called. Pope Ted. Bit of a spoiler in the title there. Yeah. Sean, what have you got?
Well, record sales are at their highest level since the 1990s. And there are now articles that I am reading about the problem of Brexit and vinyl pressing. And actually, records are really expensive, especially the heavy vinyl version. It's going to get more and more expensive because we won't be able to go to these places like Germany and Czech Republic and get things pressed cheaply. And people are really worried.
Yeah.
And they're saying, oh no, it's another reason why Brexit is actually going to impact on every single thing. So your cucumber is going to be more expensive, and also you won't be able to buy that LP that you really, really wanted to on record store day.
We're going to do this in excruciating detail on Romaniacs next week. My closing time chatter is historical dramas. Historical dramas. building budget. My mum pointed at this out the weekend. I hadn't thought about it at all. She said, I can't get with the historical dramas. Peaky Blinders, The City in the City, all of these things. You know why? The buildings are too clean. Everything else I can believe. I can believe the wigs and the hats and the teeth even. Teeth are usually done quite well these days. Horrible, poor people, blacked teeth in the Victorian time. But you look at the buildings and they're all white. Shot in Liverpool, the buildings are blindingly clean and white. Shot around, you know, bits of London, bits of Birmingham. She said it was not like that until about 1978. Every public building was completely black with coal, and she said she just could not extract herself from that. The fact that all the attention to detail that went into everything else, and yet you've got these buildings that are as clean as it would be in the 21st century, just because nobody even knows to correct that. And that has now ruined all historical drama
for me. Then your mum should be a consultant for media channels.
She should be in charge of the soot budget.
Soot budget, absolutely. So come on the BBC, at least digitally do it and make the buildings black with CGI.
I think Peaky Blinders, actually, I would say, does do that. These grimy slums of Small Heath and Birmingham are very convincingly rendered.
They are, but when you see public buildings in most other things, they tend to be. You know, The City in the City was a case in point. You know, you're supposed to be in the manky, falling down city of Bejel, and, you know, Water Street on Liverpool, it's got a little bit of a souk, a bustling souk market, but the buildings are gleaming. And that's the end of the show. Thanks to our special guests. Michael Hogan, what are you up to next?
I'm going home to probably write about Love Island.
Like
we all are.
Ooh, I'm not. You're welcome back on the show anytime. Hannah Verdier, thank you for coming in. What are you up to next?
Same as Michael, only not together.
Right, so you're both doing that. So you're both writing about Love Island.
That's basically this week, isn't it?
It's Love Island hot takes.
Yeah. Yes, and it's like TV's just been invented, but it's more of the same.
I'm in the wrong century. Thank you to everybody for coming. Thanks over to Sean Pattenden and to producer Jack Clariman. Don't forget, you can hear all of our past podcasts at audioboom.com/bigmouth. And if you want to support the show, you can buy us that invisible virtual pint via patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next week.